Robin Young, it's here and now. Congress has been finding its post-election footing this week, and one thing has been established early. The Republicans have made it clear they intend to, as President Bush said earlier, spend some political capital. To review, it's been a busy week on Capitol Hill and around Washington. We're joined now by John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Hey, Robin.
And also Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
And John, to you first. In the House, Republicans pushed through a bill that reverses a bill they themselves pushed through a decade ago. The move was designed to protect their majority leader, Tom DeLay. So, John, tell us what this was all about.
One thing we've learned in the last couple of decades in Washington, Robin, is that ethics in Washington is more about politics than it is about principle. In the 1990s, Republicans used ethics as a cudgel to beat Democrats, and they passed a rule saying that if any member of their leadership were accused of a crime for which the ultimate penalty might be 2 years or more in prison, they would have to leave their position in the leadership. That was to draw a contrast with Democrats who then faced various ethical issues related to prominent members. Now that Tom DeLay, the Republican majority leader, may be in danger of being indicted by a Texas prosecutor, they have junked that rule in order to prevent him from having to give up that post, and Democrats are now trying to use ethics as a cudgel to beat the Republicans.
And remind us, too, Peter, the charges against Tom DeLay have to do with something that he did in Texas.
That's correct. They have to do with political fundraising in regards to his effort to do redistricting down in Texas. And, of course, his redistricting down there is something the Democrats have taken great offense at and consider, in essence, itself to be a naked sort of power grab.
Well, now, the House Ethics Committee is today saying, I guess there's a letter that's been sent around, that the charges against Tom DeLay were filled with exaggerations, and they're warning lawmakers, you know, that there could be discipline if this happens again. First of all, John, you comment on that. Were these charges exaggerated, and how much is all of this just political hardball?
I think most of it on both sides is political hardball. The things that Tom DeLay in Texas has come under a cloud for, and people close to him have been indicted for by this Texas prosecutor, have to do with political fundraising and where money raised from corporate sources can be used in political campaigns. Everybody knows that these lines get drawn in laws, and the political parties and their operatives then try to figure out ways to use the money that they were always using but not run afoul of the laws. And Tom DeLay is somebody who plays a mean game of hardball and who goes close to the line. And the question is that this prosecutor is considering is whether he's gone over it. And Democrats, of course, are arguing that he has, but that hasn't been proven yet.
Well, and even if he has and he's punished for it, he's now protected by his own party with this new bill that they've just pushed through. And just one last thought, John. Do you have to be a Democrat in Congress to think that that's unfair, or are there Republicans who are also uneasy with this?
Well, there are some Republicans who think it's the wrong signal to send, and the vulnerability for Republicans is that, you know, Republicans were successful in painting the Democrats as sort of power mad and corrupt when they were running the Congress, and that became one element of a broader indictment, political indictment they had, which allowed them to regain control of the Congress. If Democrats can use the issue of ethical transgression in coordination with other issues as well, you know, maybe they could make some headway against this Republican majority. But right now, especially given the way district lines are drawn these days, it looks like Democrats are going to have a difficult time in the foreseeable future to oust them from power.
Right. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But I want to move on first to Senator Arlen Specter. Peter, boy, he took a beating from the right in his own party over the last couple of weeks. He is going to become head of the Senate Judicial Committee after all, but party members had objected to the comment he made, indicating that judges aiming to overturn Roe versus Wade would have a hard time getting appointed. Specter is called a liberal by members of his own party. He's gotten the role, but was there some cost, Peter?
Well, cost, I think, is in the eye of the beholder. What Arlen Specter had to do was basically get up and humiliate himself a little bit in front of the conservatives who'd been complaining about him. He read out a list of things that he'd agreed to do. He promised there would be no litmus test in regards to various issues for judicial candidates before his committee. And also, he implicitly promised to back this so-called nuclear option, in which it is possible that the Senate Republicans would move to do away with filibusters, at least filibusters in regards to judicial nominations.
Yeah, and, you know, keeping with that and the idea that Republicans are obviously trying to consolidate their power, Peter, your paper had an analysis piece today that says that dangers lurk for both parties. You know, on the Republican side, the risk that this huge, or what they see as a huge victory in a mandate, could lead to hubris and downfall. On the Democratic side, that you can get used to being the demoralized minority party. And, John, take a look at the Republicans first. Too much power? Are you abusing the power? What are you seeing?
Well, obviously that depends on what side of the red-blue line you fall on.
Right.
But the one thing that we know is that Republicans now have clear control of all of Washington. They will be accountable for the results, and they're going to have a chance to pass some very, very difficult elements of their program, things like Social Security reform, tax reform, that haven't been easy to do. As George Bush said after the election, if it had been easy to do, we'd already have seen it done. But they're also, one of the reasons they haven't been done is because they're politically risky. And Democrats are certainly going to be there, if things go wrong, to say they're in charge and they've messed it up. Didn't work for them in the 2004 campaign, and George W. Bush won a victory. It was a clear victory, but it wasn't an overwhelming one. And so this is why I think Democrats have some hope. If they can get their act together and Republicans stumble a bit, they don't have that far to travel before they get to a national majority.
And, Peter, you mentioned the nuclear option, you know, this attempt to stop filibustering. Bill Frist is supposed to get broader powers to fill committee vacancies, you know, to keep GOP members in line. Is this the Senate looking less senatorial?
Well, yeah, you know, I think the interesting thing about the Senate right now, and let's leave the short-term politics out of this for the moment. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about it is that these are very radical moves in an historical sense. You know, the Senate is traditionally the conservative chamber of Congress. It's, in the famous phrase, the place where you pour policy out into the saucer and let it cool before enacting it. Everything that the Republicans are talking about doing would make the Senate act, in essence, more efficiently and more quickly and make it more like the House. And, you know, that's really part of an historical trend. I mean, if you look at filibusters, prior to World War I, one senator could carry on a filibuster. That was changed under President Woodrow Wilson. Then to the fact where two-thirds of a vote was needed to break cloture or to break a filibuster. Then in 1975, they changed that further. They found that not moderate enough, and they lowered it to the current 60 votes for cloture. If we go now down and do away with filibusters to 51, that'll just be really the logical outcome of a process that's been going on for almost 100 years.
Well, and we only have a few seconds left, but John, the Democrats getting used to being the minority party. I heard David Brooks say, columnist David Brooks, that the powerless could be as dangerous as power. They could just get darn wacky. In the few seconds we have, what do they have to do?
Democrats have got to figure out a way to convince mainstream America that they share their values and priorities. The problem is, each party has a base with it, an ideological base on one side or the other, but the Republican base among conservatives is much bigger. Democrats have got to begin to dominate the vote of independents and moderate voters. Then they can get close to a national majority.
And try not to get wacky, whatever that means. John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Peter Greer, Washington editor for the Christian Science Monitor. Thank you both. What a week.
My pleasure.
Anytime.
And now a two-part look at marketing and minorities. In a moment, Abercrombie and Fitch forced to change its policy on diversity. But first, a study out this week raises the possibility of the first ever race-specific drug, a pill which would be marketed exclusively to African Americans. The two-drug combination pill, Bidil, has been shown to dramatically reduce deaths among black patients with heart disease. The Food and Drug Administration is expected to approve the medication, which is made by the pharmaceutical company Nitromed. Here in Monica Brady-Meyerhoff reports on reaction.
The Bidil announcement has sparked interest and some concern in the medical community. Dr. Jerry Avorn, associate professor of medicine at Harvard and author of Powerful Medicines, says Nitromed's findings might result in other drug companies dredging their data for findings particular to race.
It may well be that this will create a fad and that other companies will try and see, was there a subgroup of this or that complexion that might be a marketing target for another drug based on another study.
Avorn says this could result in more race-based drugs coming on the market. That would be a good thing, says Wayne Kong, CEO of the Association of Black Cardiologists. He says we're moving into a new era of personalized treatments. Kong, whose organization co-sponsored the study, says it doesn't show black people are different from other races.
If the science shows that treatment works, it doesn't matter what population you tested on, we need to trust the science. So it doesn't mean that it doesn't work with anyone else, but in this particular study, we used self-identified African-American patients.
Nitromed developed Bidil as a combination of two old drugs. The race-specific finding was almost an accident. Dr. Greg Block, who teaches health law policy at Georgetown University, says this unique finding made the drug move through the FDA regulatory maze faster. Block says he expects more pharmaceuticals will be race-conscious when developing new drugs, if only to get to market sooner.
Nitromed's predecessor was unable to get this drug approved as a medication for everybody. They then did this trial, which gives them powerful data that enables them to get the drug approved in all probability as a medication for African Americans only. And now, having gotten to market that way, they're planning to, in fact, market the drug as a medication for everybody.
Nitromed's lead author of the study says they will work to identify other populations for the drug. Avorn of Harvard Medical School says this drug could prompt pharmacologists to do more research in the understudied area of how different races react to drugs.
There almost certainly are going to be important differences between blacks and whites and Asians and perhaps Hispanics. We know that there are important gender differences between men and women. And for the most part, those differences have in the past been swept under the rug.
But there are pitfalls and misunderstandings when looking at the differences between races, says Block.
When this reaches the water cooler conversations and the talk show circuit and the like, it's at risk of being translated into a story about blacks being fundamentally, genetically, or biologically different. And that's not what these investigators have shown.
But racial differences could become a marketing ploy, says Dr. Michael Groden, a medical ethicist at Boston University's School of Public Health.
The idea of making good, effective, and beneficial drugs that are more specific, that have less side effects, and that are better drugs for specific populations is a wonderful thing. The question is whether it's ethically justifiable to do it if it's not going to actually benefit those people, because it has to ultimately be affordable.
By proving Bidil works on African Americans, Nitromed was able to extend its patent out to the year 2020, thereby keeping cheaper generic drugs off the market and securing its hold on the first race-specific drug.
That report by Monica Brady Myroff. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's soon going to be a new look for Abercrombie & Fitch. If you go to the website of the Ohio-based retailer, you see beautiful young blondes modeling the preppy clothing that's been marketed so successfully to teens and 20-somethings for years. But this week, a group of young minority job applicants successfully sued the company. A judge approved a settlement that forces Abercrombie & Fitch to pay $40 million to prevent discrimination in its workforce and in its marketing. College student Eddie Gonzalez was one of the plaintiffs.
I was looking for a summer job, so I went to Abercrombie, and I asked them what positions they were hiring for. And the lady I spoke to said that while they were hiring for all positions, I personally should apply to be in the stock room or the overnight crew.
Well, under the settlement that Gonzalez and eight other original plaintiffs won, Abercrombie & Fitch admits no wrongdoing. Company president and chief operating officer Bob Singer says the settlement will require a new way of thinking, but not much else.
I think that essentially it will not be a change. I think that we will continue to manage with the same values we've always had. And I think obviously what I hope and believe will happen is that the result will be that the company's employees and the company's customers will become an ever more diverse group.
Joining us on the line is Kathleen Siders. She's Associate Professor of Marketing at Boston College. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, and we just heard that Abercrombie & Fitch will continue with the same values it's always had. Some parents have questioned those values. As you well know, naughty but nice is one of its slogans, and Abercrombie & Fitch has had some steamy and controversial advertising. But what do you make of this judge's order that the new advertising has to be more diverse? Has that ever happened before?
This is a really extensive ruling in this settlement, and very interesting because opening the door for Abercrombie to take a different approach to marketing, in a sense, I think this approach can be leveraged for the company. I don't think this has to be a negative thing at all. I don't think the settlement financially will have a strong impact, negative impact, on the company. And I think that Abercrombie has recognized that it's been following very outmoded HR practices and that inequity is no longer acceptable and could be detrimental in the future. I think that's how this settlement came about.
Well, you talked about the human resources practices, but, you know, the advertising, you say it opens the door for Abercrombie & Fitch, and some would say it's forcing them through a door. And I'm wondering how much more profoundly white is the so-called A&F culture? You know, was it revealed that they have a marketing strategy that says we want to sell the blonde white culture to kids?
Well, that could be. You could also say that this is a company that's very focused on a very specific target market. Abercrombie is interesting because you can look at this as two different dimensions in a way. You have this HR dimension, and you have this homogeneous kind of target dimension. On the other side, you have this very, very risque approach to marketing, kind of the shock value, but that can be very effective in terms of getting a response from that specific customer. So in a lot of ways, that works quite well for the company. But Abercrombie has to be careful because they're treading on thin ice in two areas right now, and that's probably too much risk to take.
Yeah, both the perception of racism and the steaminess alongside it. But in your opinion, is the judge also saying hiring practices are a part of advertising? In other words, who you put on the floor and who you put back in the stockroom is an advertising technique?
Well, we believe that in marketing. We believe that who you put on the floor, that those contact people, is a strategic marketing variable.
Well, how is this going to affect the company then, that the legal settlement requires them to hire these workforce diversity monitors to provide training to managers and also stop recruiting for their, you know, floor workforce at predominantly white college fraternities and sororities?
I think that they will still look for the Abercrombie type, but they're going to have to diversify that type. This is a very image-driven company, and that's not going to change. That's the message.
What about other companies that target groups as well? I'm thinking of FUBU, for instance, For Us, By Us, sort of a hip-hop African-American clothing line. They market to primarily African-Americans or kids who want that look. It's an African-American look. We went to their website, all black faces. I know you can't comment on whether or not they could be targeted as well. You're not a lawyer, but how does the marketing world look at those companies?
Well, when you look at a company like that, you're looking at more niche marketing. And in our field, diversity marketing is very accepted. And part of diversity marketing includes being able to speak to market niches very clearly in a very targeted sort of way.
Of course, right now, one huge difference between FUBU and Abercrombie & Fitch is that nobody has sued. Nobody has sued because they weren't hired because of their color.
And I think it would be a stretch. When you think about this practice of diversity marketing, this is designed to reach groups that have traditionally been disenfranchised.
It's almost as if Abercrombie & Fitch's biggest mistake was being way behind the times.
I think that these practices are dated and reflect a blind spot in this company, and I believe the company has acknowledged that now. This is a mainstream company. Right? This is not a company that's targeting a specific niche. It's targeting a specific age group, and that's quite different. You can look at a company like Urban Outfitters, for example, targeting very much the same age group with a different style, not the preppy style, but certainly with a much more diverse approach and another very successful retailer.
So Abercrombie & Fitch is going to be more diverse, but meanwhile, in 2002, it launched a sale of thong underwear to 10 to 14-year-old girls adorned with images of cherries and messages like wink, wink, and eye candy. Are there more problems to be addressed here? How do you feel about that as a marketer?
I don't think that this is going to stop. I think we can look at this whole issue as a trade-off. Abercrombie has to trade off these kinds of outdated HR practices in order to maintain its very risque, controversial approach to advertising. This is its personality. This is its marketing approach and personality. It's not going to give that up.
Kathleen Siders, Associate Professor of Marketing at Boston College. Kathleen, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And next week on Here and Now, lawyers may love legalese, but juries don't. We'll look at a move in California to rid the courts of legal jargon in favor of plain English. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Rebel leaders and the Sudanese government today signed a pledge to end by January the 21-year civil war between the Islamist government and the largely Christian South. There have been other peace agreements in the past, but this is the first with a deadline. The pledge comes after the UN Security Council made the extraordinary move of convening in Nairobi to confront the problem in Sudan, which is racked by two wars that have left millions of people dead. The second conflict is in the Darfur region in western Sudan, where Arab militias, backed by the government, have been targeting civilians in a campaign of murder, rape, and arson. Amel Gharani is a Sudanese-born aid worker who works out of an opposition area in Sudan. She recently came to the U.S. with the group Women Waging Peace to remind legislators of the toll of the fighting on women, who are raped as they leave refugee camps to collect wood and marginalized by a traditionally patriarchal society that's been waging unreported war for years.
People don't know that this government has killed so many people. Around the oil fields, there is massive displacement still. There are bombings. There is the government pursues the same policy of scorched earth policy, burning villages, displacing people to move them away from the oil fields.
And women in particular have been raped, brutalized.
People who work with women in the camps have been spending a lot of time just convincing women to speak about it. They would go, for example, to doctors seeking medical help. And once they see a male doctor, because there aren't so many female doctors that are working in the area, they would just all of a sudden say, well, I have a headache. They wouldn't even speak about their problems. They try to get rid of the babies.
And is it true, we're hearing some reports that the government-backed Janjaweed, the government-backed militia, has been in part raping the women to impregnate them?
Yes. It's ethnic cleansing, just like what happened in Bosnia.
Yeah, because the women who are being raped are largely African Muslim as opposed to Arab?
Yeah, there is a certain clear racial issue here, and it is also a way of humiliating the other. It's a weapon of war, and it's also a way of ethnic cleansing that we will get rid of. We will see to that we wipe out this race, for example.
What do you want done to correct it? What can reverse this?
There has to be special protection in the camps, and it cannot be by the police, who are Sudanese army officers or Sudanese police, government police, because these are the people who have been also part of the problem. So there has to be international presence. Women have to be involved in the camp management. The ways they have to go to collect firewood or whatever their needs are have to be secured. There has to be training of police officers who are women, and as well as a presence of female doctors, and to listen to the women. They know their problems. They know what they need, but they have not been included. We have 80% to 90% women in the refugee camps, 80% to 90% women and children, but you'd see very few of these in the camp management. In the north, women are oppressed in a very different way. We have Sharia laws, for example. We have great restrictions on the movement of women. So women have come together long before these peace processes, and I have been actually starting dialogues from the north and the south in different parts of the country to launch informal peace talks. But these have been all ignored once the formal peace process started, because it only included the warring factions. But in fact, what's been sustaining these societies is the work of women who, you know, kept families together, who look after orphans. There is a great number of orphans. There are a great number of disabled people. You have so many households headed by women today. And in the midst of the war, where people had difficulty talking to the other part, the party, you know, people from the south, for example, talking to women from the south and women from the north, it is a very difficult thing to just sit at the same table and be able to talk to people who may have killed your brother or your husband or, you know, your children. And women made that decision.
But you want people to know women are persecuted in Sudan outside of war. Tick off some of the ways.
Well, for example, I mean, the age of marriage, as it stands today in the constitution, is 10 years old.
In Sudan?
Yes. And it's ridiculous. I visited, for example, the SPLM camp where I saw a fire. I thought it was just a fire, but it turned out to be a woman committing suicide. She was only 14 years old. Her mother wanted her to, you know, get married. And at the end, she felt so helpless. So she
You saw that?
I saw that. This was one of the issues, and of the things that I've seen.
And that was in a camp set up by one of the opposition forces, as you said, for refugees escaping. What other ways that we might not think of as Americans are women's lives endangered, compromised?
Well, for example, the women who brew alcoholic drinks in the north, these are the majority of them come from Western Sudan and from South Sudan. They are being persecuted heavily and punished severely for selling alcoholic drinks, which is forbidden, while other crimes don't get that much persecution. So there is this crackdown on the rights of women in so many different ways. But also, for example, virginity tests. Women who are oppositional, or women who the government has an issue with, get called to police stations. There is no legal backing for this, but they get subjected to virginity tests. And it doesn't only affect her, but it affects her whole family. There is no way most people, you know, they just keep silent about it.
Well, now human rights groups and others are saying no more peace pledges. You know, the UN should take a harder line, more intervention, for instance.
Intervention would be important as a multinational force. For example, as a UN force, it would be good.
Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times columnist, has said that the U.S. administration has done only enough to stop children from being thrown onto bonfires, to allow them to merely starve to death. He's calling for no-fly zones and sanctions. And how do you feel about those?
Sanctions and no-fly zones. I mean, if you say sanctions in Sudan, people, what comes to mind is the experience of Iraq, and people are very wary of sanctions. On the other hand, targeted sanctions in the sense of an arms embargo on the government, in the sense of freezing of assets and a travel ban on government members who are known to have violated and have committed gross violations of human rights, that would be welcome. And it's important because the government is just, not taking threats seriously and appearing to comply but never having to really comply, and nothing is happening.
Well, Amel Gharani, thank you so much for telling us about so many of these issues.
Thank you for inviting me to speak here. Thank you.
Amel Gharani, Executive Director of Sudan Future Care. Well, still to come, award-winning books and bestsellers that are off the radar screen with the editor of the New York Times Sunday Book Review. You're listening to Here and Now. In Egypt, the hunt is on to find the muazzin with the most beautiful voice to perform the call to prayer for Cairo's mosques. The country's religious endowments minister wants there to be just one call to prayer sung from all of the city's thousands of mosques in order to make Cairo a quieter and less stressful place. But the proposal has caused outrage, as reporter Malcolm Brabant reports from Cairo.
This is the minister's dream, one unified adhan, or call to prayer, for thousands of minarets. He claims he wants to reduce decibels in one of the noisiest cities in the world. Outside Cairo's main Al-Azhar Mosque, on their way to Friday prayers, two worshippers express diametrically opposed views. The call to prayer will be on a CD. It won't work, and it's sinful. But his opponent says this idea could work. There are so many calls to prayer in one area, they always overlap. It's pointless. Inside the mosque, after the main devotions, about 100 of the faithful, some carrying protest banners, gather around banned Islamist politician Magdi Ahmed Hussein. He sweats profusely as he works himself into a fury to denounce the minister's proposal as a sinister plot which must be opposed. Outside in the exquisite marble courtyard, Mr. Hussein dries himself off and his demeanor becomes much calmer.
I really doubt that the government is acting in the interests of Egypt. It's all part of a campaign imposed by the Americans to change the tone and content of our religious teachings. All Arab rulers who are allied with the Americans are giving in to the pressure and trying to change our teachings.
This tense atmosphere, I think it's responsible for this decision.
Leading Egyptian playwright Ali Salem also opposes the unification of the adhan, but on the grounds that it's unworkable.
They ignore the nature of people. In every mosque, there is somebody who believes that his voice is sweet and beautiful and strong, and he wants to call for prayer. Allahu Akbar,
Allahu Akbar. Mahmoud Mohammed Hamzi is one such muazzin. Five times a day he calls the faithful to prayer in a small mosque in the basement of an apartment block in a middle-class district of Cairo. The mosque is right next door to the study of historian Maged Farag, who believes the government should ban microphones and speakers instead.
The mosque next door is trying to compete with the other mosque that is also next door. In my opinion, it's a very uncivilized thing. Cairo has thousands of mosques, and it has always been a very pleasant thing to listen to the prayer, the call for prayer from all the mosques around you, one after the other. It's like a harmonious piece of art. When you add the microphones to it, it becomes a torturing experience.
But Dr. Farag's nemesis, Mahmoud Mohammed Hamzi, is clearly in no mood to surrender what he believes is his holy duty.
The call to prayer is God's call to prayer. It comes from the heart. It is pure by itself, regardless of how it is delivered. You just need to say, God is great.
Egypt's Minister for Religious Endowment denies that his proposal is a Western plot, and despite the overwhelming criticism, he says he's determined to press ahead. But he declined to be interviewed for this report. Playwright Ali Salem believes such reluctance is a sign that the idea of the unified Avan will vanish like a desert breeze.
We will lose our time, we'll exhaust ourselves in something which will not be carried out. Practically, no one could implement this decision. It will be forgotten gradually.
Whatever happens, the issue of Cairo's noise still remains unresolved. But the debate has given stressed-out Cairenes the chance to convince their neighbours that they don't have to be loud to be religious.
Reporter Malcolm Brabant in Cairo. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And the winners are book lovers who might want to grab pen and paper because a lot of good books are in the ether. From this week's National Book Award winners and the runner-ups worth mentioning to some of the hottest poetry books. Joining us on the line from his office at the New York Times is Sam Tannenhaus. He's editor of the Sunday Book Review, and he's here to deliver his occasional book report for us. Hi, Sam.
Glad to be here. Glad to talk to you.
Now stand up and tell the class what did you love out of this week's award winners.
Kevin Boyle's book, Arc of Justice, is a really fine piece of reconstructive journalism, that is narrative history.
That's a nonfiction book award winner, and it was a story of a murder in the early 1920s?
That's right. It's a murder civil rights case. A black family broke the color line in Detroit, and a mob descended upon them, and someone was killed. And it was one of the early important civil rights cases, and the author has captured that era and its racial and social and economic tensions impressively. It's a fine book.
Kevin Boyle's book called Arc of Justice, A Saga of Race, Civil Rights, and Murder in the Jazz Age. And it beat out the 9/11 Commission report. Some people thought, you know, that was such an odd nomination and such compelling reading. Some people thought it might win, but Kevin Boyle beat him out.
Well, it's hard to give a prize to a committee, I think, even when it's a committee awarding the prize. The 9/11 Commission report is kind of a landmark in our governmental writing, but it did very well to get nominated, and that speaks highly for it. It's also been a number one bestseller at various times.
Right.
And probably doesn't need a prize to keep its momentum going.
Well, now, the book world was abuzz over the nominees in the fiction category, five obscure female writers. Lily Tuck got the National Book Award stamp for her News from Paraguay.
Yes, this is a historical novel, but one written in a kind of minimalist interior way about a figure based on historical truth who's a kind of Evita. Person. She came from Ireland and became the mistress of a dictator in Paraguay. And the novel sort of combines her interior journey with the external horrors of one of the worst dictatorships of the era. And it's a imaginative and daring book.
By the way, some of the runner-ups, Ideas of Heaven, A Ring of Stories by Joan Silber, two other titles, Madeline is Sleeping and Florida. Really good books, but oh heavens, no Philip Roth, no Tom Wolfe. Will they recover?
I think they will. They've garnered enough accolades in their day. Among the other finalists, I would particularly recommend Kate Walbert's novel and short story. She's quite a gifted fiction writer who has been emerging as an important voice in contemporary fiction.
We want to mention the top prize for young people's literature was interesting. It went to Pete Houtman's Godless. It's the story of a skeptical teenager who helps found a religion centered around a water tower. It sounds very sweet, but I'm wondering, you know, in the current climate, how long before it gets banned?
That was the great theme of the day, as we know, at the National Book Awards. Judy Blume, who was honored with a special citation, mentioned the encroaching fear of censorship, and actually will be doing something in the book review about the question of censorship, which is more complicated than you might think. And it's even become, it seems, a kind of badge of honor to have one's book censored. And we'll be looking at that question from various angles.
Okay. But in the meantime, in your upcoming book review, this Sunday's magazine, which, by the way, I've got it in my hand. Be careful, readers, because it looks a little bit like an advertising circular. It's got this wildly wonderful, colorful cover. And it's the poetry issue. First time ever that the magazine has really celebrated poetry to this extent.
That's right. Yes, the cover is a little like an Andy Warhol painting from the 1960s. Someone said it looked like a detergent box.
Yeah.
But it's attractive and interesting, and really what's important are the names. And the centerpiece is what we call a symposium. We asked 8 exceptionally brilliant, celebrated poets, including John Ashbery, James Fenton, and one very famous critic, Harold Bloom, mm-hmm. to choose their favorite book of poetry written in the past 25 years. And these are personal essays. It's a very rich and an interesting collection of voices on this most overlooked, but we sometimes forget, most distilled and important form of literary communication we have, which is the poem.
Yeah. We note that Jim Harrison writes about Gary Snyder. Robert Pinsky writes about James McMichael. What are some of the other poets that are whose books are featured?
Well, since we've been talking about the National Book Awards, Jean Valentine, who won for poetry, is reviewed in this issue. There is the final book by the great Polish Nobel laureate Czesław Miłosz. James Merrill, the late great poet, has a prose collection that's out, which we review as if it is an extension of his poetry. And that's something the issue is trying to do, is to show how poetry is not the very narrow, small, self-contained elite world you might think it is, but something that touches all the cultural activity of the time.
Why poetry now?
I'll tell you why. Because we saw a lot of terrific books, and we thought it would be fun to make something of it. And this seemed like a moment when we could collect the most interest and attention, and we hope it works.
And by the way, just as long as we have this advanced copy, which we love having this sneak peek, let people know as well that you will have your, as usual, bestseller list, and note that the top 3 nonfiction books this week are America, the Book by Jon Stewart, When Will Jesus Bring the Pork Chops by George Carlin, How to Talk to a Liberal If You Must by Ann Coulter, and over in fiction, Metro Girl, Janet Ivanovich, Our Game by David Baldacci, and The Da Vinci Code, still, by Dan Brown, 86 weeks on the list. Is there another book you can compare that to? It's so popular.
Well, I'll tell you, there's a book even more popular that everyone kind of missed, except for the 20 million people who've read it in America, because we put it on a different bestseller list, called A Purpose-Driven Life, by Rick Warren, an evangelical minister in California. We have an essay running shortly that argues we may have all missed the boat in the last election. We were looking so hard at the political books that we forgot about the religious ones. Mm. So our new writer, our first ever staff writer, Rachel Donadio, has done an interesting essay, very deeply reported, with sales figures and interviews with some of the authors about the new awakening of religious literature in America.
And what's the name of that book again?
It's called The Purpose-Driven Life. Mm-hmm. Sold 19 million copies in English and 1 million more in Spanish.
Okay. And one last mention we want to make. The review has its usual book reviews as well as poetry book reviews, and we want to point to Sekutu Mehta's Maximum City. It's a terrific book on Bombay, and we have an interview with the author coming up very soon, but that's another one I would think to keep your eye on, right, Sam?
Wonderfully ambitious book, very richly, densely textured. Our reviewer praised it quite extravagantly, as well he should have. It's a very interesting work, and we're happy to feature it in our section.
Well, Sam Tannenhaus, as usual, so much reading, so little time. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
I've got a really long list here. Sam Tannenhaus, editor of the Sunday New York Times Book Review. For more information on the books we discussed, check out our website, here-now.org. Ornette Coleman with his appropriate tune, Storytellers. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Thanks this week to George Hicks and Ann Stevenson. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Will Thompson. Our newscast producer is Lindsay Crudell. Our interns are Danielle Dreilinger, John McAvoy, and Jen Miller. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio, have a great weekend, and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.